Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Melanie, and I'm reading from the Big Bend Sentinel.
As coronavirus crisis drags on, businesses aren't foundations. Imagine reopening. People are over it, one business owner said of lockdowns. Well, coronavirus isn't over us. By Stephen Paulson, June 10th, 2020, read by Melanie. Marfa. As tourists have slowly returned to Marfa, the Chinati Foundation has been wondering what it will look like to welcome them back. Last week, the foundation invited select local guests to help in testing our reopening scenario, as Executive Director Jenny Moore put it in a phone interview on Monday. Chinati Foundation has been consulting with local health experts and has no set date to reopen, Moore said. But the group knows it has to reopen eventually and is already developing a range of safety measures, from requiring face masks to closing restrooms. Last Friday, some local guests got to see what that looked like. They booked their visits online, registering particular time slots to conform with social distancing. Buildings were closed, and gone were the guided tours. Instead, Moore said, they've developed new signage, making it a self-guided tour. Chinati Foundation is also considering a phased opening by, for example, opening the grounds before they open buildings. For Moore, the trial run was about helping the foundation walk through the process as we move towards an opening day. This is very much a process, she added. We're moving slowly with safety first. Not all Marfans have to grapple with the logistics of opening a sprawling art destination, but Moore's situation mirrors that of business owners across the Tri-Country as they grapple with reopening in a state that shows a do-it-yourself approach over strict statewide rules and long lockdowns. Texas Governor Greg Abbott started a phased reopening of Texas in late April, a move that gave the state one of the shortest lockdown orders in the country at well under a month. Many businesses were allowed to start reopening again by May 1st. At the same time, Abbott also overturned local decisions to take precautions, rejecting face mask requirements in cities from Presidio to Houston and nixing Presidio County's temporary ban on short-term rentals. In a press conference on the reopening, Abbott described his rules as permission to open, not a requirement. But especially when coupled with the overturning of local rules, some Marfans felt like the state was passing the buck to them. We have had lack of leadership from the state and nationally, said Buck Johnston, a city council member and co-owner of Wrong Marfa, who is relying on her own judgment as she navigates the state reopening process. People are kind of confused about what the right thing is to do. I wish we had more direction. With her dual role as a public official, Johnston felt a need to be extra cautious. Being on council, I need to set an example, she said. Last month, Johnston started organizing public meetings on Zoom to discuss the process of reopening businesses. The meetings were open to everyone, but primarily catered to business owners who wanted to discuss what protocols would protect both customers and businesses. A wide range of local businesses soon joined, from shops and art galleries to, full disclosure, the Sentinel. They've been really supportive, Johnston said of the calls. Not only did they help businesses coordinate on best practices, but they served as outlets for other business people who were struggling with these same logistical and ethical challenges in a town that runs on tourism and the service industry. We made sure when we started these meetings that there was no judgment about reopening, Johnston said. People have to make money. We can't be shaming each other. Among the participants in Johnston's Zoom meetings was Kate Calder, the new owner of Community Marfa. Previously an employee at the store, Calder bought the business in May. As a new business owner, Calder was wary about how to proceed with reopening. On one hand, since she didn't own Community Markfa before the coronavirus crisis. She says she didn't qualify for some of the emergency loans and payouts given to more established businesses. Being the owner, I have a lot of bills to pay, she said. This is my livelihood. On the other hand, Calder loves Markfa and didn't want to do anything that might harm it. The numbers are going the wrong direction right now, she said of the state's case count. And like Johnston, she felt frustrated with the lack of good information coming from state and federal leaders, as well as what she felt was a growing desire across the state and country to forget about the coronavirus and move on. People are over it, she said of the crisis. They're setting it aside. Well, coronavirus isn't over us. For both Calder and Johnston, the Zoom calls helped them get a sense of protocols and best practices that left them feeling safer about attempting a reopening. It started as a planning session, but it became more of a feedback session, Calder said. Businesses that had reopened shared their input with those that hadn't. Calder opened a couple of weeks ago on Memorial Day weekend. Community Markfa is now appointment only, and Calder offers sanitizer and face coverings to guests. Johnston, meanwhile, is planning to reopen this weekend. She'll be adopting protocols similar to Calder's, including requiring face coverings. I even considered turnstiles, she said with a laugh. It remains to be seen when Markfa will open more fully or whether the return of tourists and semi-normalcy will lead to more spikes in cases in the region. For business owners forced to make these tough decisions, it hasn't been easy. I still don't know if it's necessarily safe that our town has reopened, Johnston said. Other business owners wouldn't argue it isn't. And that's perhaps particularly true for businesses like restaurants, whose business models focus on eating and social interactions. Nearly all of Markfa's restaurants are still to-go only or have temporarily closed altogether, like Selena and Capri. Krista Steinhauer, owner at Selena, was perhaps the first business owner in the Tri-County to shut down as a precaution against coronavirus. Within days, businesses across Markfa followed her lead. In an interview Tuesday, Steinhauer still didn't feel completely comfortable putting any timeline on her reopening. She pointed to a number of factors, from Texas's still rising case counts to the fact that there's kind of a two-week lag time of exposure in recorded cases, as people who became infected with coronavirus weeks ago start to show symptoms and await test results. Steinhauer didn't want to speak in detail about her plans for Selena's future, but she was adamant about one fact. It's not going to be a full-service restaurant anytime soon. I wish everybody would agree that eating a nice meal with full service is not important right now, she added. There are more important things going on. After the interview, Steinhauer shared a news article describing how some Austin restaurants were once again shuttering as employees came down with coronavirus. This is going to keep happening, she wrote. Why gear up to open, which is no small task, only to shut down again? For more, the Chinati director, the last few months, have represented the challenge of making really difficult decisions as locals grapple with an unprecedented pandemic and what that means for the local tourist industry. We were about to en masse close down very quickly in service of public safety and the public at large, she said. It's clearly a much more complicated process to open.
Cases climb in Tri-County as contact tracing overwhelms state and officials warn of spread. By Abby Perot, Steve Paulson, June 17, 2020. Read by Melanie. Tri-County. Coronavirus is gaining a foothold in the Tri-County region, with officials in both Presidio and Brewster counties warning of community spread as local case counts reach 9 active and 1 recovered in Presidio County, and 21 active and 1 recovered in Brewster County. At press time, Jeff Davis County is still at 0 cases. Coronavirus has been in the region since April, when Brewster County reported its first confirmed case. But for the first time, officials are seeing cases with no clear origin and are assuming community spread, meaning residents could pick up the disease not just with trips to El Paso and beyond, but with outings in the local community. And with the growing case counts, it has fallen to the regional state health department to track the spread in West Texas. 5 investigators in our region are working full-time to do the contact tracing, Presidio County Judge Cinderella Guevara said Wednesday. The investigators are medical personnel, and they are bogged down and have the whole region to take care of. Our region includes areas that have nursing homes, and quite frankly, their priority is going to be the nursing homes because of how vulnerable those people are, said Guevara. A map of Region 9 and 10 of the Department of State Health Services shows the Tri-County is grouped into a region with 36 counties that cover El Paso, Midland-Odessa, and other rural areas in West Texas, like Crane, where a recent outbreak in a nursing home is driving case increases. The 5 core investigators are currently assisted by 6 surge team members to contact households of people who test positive in Region 9 and 10. All others potentially exposed to those who tested positive are now put through the state's new online program, where tracers from across the state are assigned to contact people. In a report from April laying out Texas' reopening plans, state officials said they plan to coordinate with local health officials and fully mobilize contact tracing of up to 4,000 tracers. For contrast, Illinois also plans to hire 4,000 contact tracers despite having less than half of Texas' population. And as the Texas Tribune reported this month, Texas has even fallen short of that goal. By June 4th, the state had hired fewer than 3,000 such tracers, including 600 people at a company that received a $295 million contract from the state. As reported by the Dallas Morning News, that company, MTX Group, won't reveal the subcontractors involved in the project or say how much the tracers are being paid. When Governor Greg Abbott first allowed reopening, small counties like Presidio and Brewster with fewer than 5 cases could apply to open at an even higher capacity if they could meet a few requirements, including contact tracing plan. When Presidio and Brewster judges reached out to the DSHS about making their own contact tracing plans, they were told the state would instead take care of it for them. Following that assurance, they applied and opened at a higher capacity, depending on DSHS, for local tracing needs. In an interview Tuesday, Presidio County Health Authority Dr. John Paul Schwartz said he hadn't heard from DSHS officials since they had last confirmed a case on Friday, June 5th, 11 days earlier. "I'm just not getting the support that I need," Schwartz said. "I'm not getting the feedback." After multiple attempts by the Big Bend Sentinel to contact the Texas Department of State Health Services in Austin at press time, the agency had not responded to requests for comment about contact tracing or the escalating situation in far West Texas. Throughout the coronavirus pandemic, Texas DSHS has only responded to one press request from the Big Bend Sentinel, and even then, they did not fully answer our questions. The Big Bend Sentinel last week filed a records request with the agency asking for detailed information on its local contact tracing efforts and is awaiting a response to the request. Local officials are frustrated at the meager response of the health department to the area. Dr. Schwartz said, "Contact tracing is not generally discussed once the single case has been described," he said. "There doesn't seem to be lots of follow-up of what happens later. That's been my experience." On June 5th, Presidio County officials said they'd found a confirmed case of coronavirus in Marfa, a man in his 40s who is believed to have contracted the disease from traveling. Luis Jr. Nunez, a Marfa resident, confirmed in a phone interview with the Big Bend Sentinel that he was that patient. And with 4 family members living at his home, health officials are treating those 4 as probables, which are not counted in official tallies. One of the family members' employers had expected to hear from the state about tracing, repeatedly checking their email and phones for any messages, but the employer confirmed that 12 days after the case was announced, they still had not been contacted. On Tuesday night, another local business, Barbecue Eatery Convenience West, said on social media that it was temporarily closing after being in contact with someone who had tested positive for coronavirus. They found out not from state health officials, but from the concerned COVID positive person.
Mark Scott, chef and one of the owners of the restaurant, said a resident who had stopped by to pick up food later contacted them to disclose they'd tested positive for coronavirus at a mobile testing site in Marfa on Friday. One of the newly announced cases here. At press time on Wednesday, the restaurant had not yet heard from the state. Zero contact at the moment, Scott said in a follow-up call Wednesday morning. In a phone call on Wednesday, Greg Davis, a Border Patrol spokesperson, confirmed that an employee of Big Bend Sector Headquarters in Marfa had tested positive for coronavirus. The employee is believed to have had contracted the disease through travel and is now quarantining at home, Davis said. Local Board Patrol officials have not yet heard from the Department of State Health Services regarding the case. In a small community like ours, word travels faster than they can do their investigation, Judge Guevara said about the state's attempts to trace new cases as they emerge. On Wednesday, Presidio County officially announced 8 new cases in Marfa, all results from the most recent drive-through testing in Marfa. Based on contact tracing investigations, all patients have residence in Marfa, Texas. All are community transmission. The majority of the cases range from no symptoms to mild symptoms, according to Judge Guevara. Patients range in age from their teens to their 60s. Alpine is not proven immune to rising case counts either. After finding a corona case in South County in April, Brewster County's case count sat for weeks at just 1. That patient recovered. Then on Saturday, Brewster County announced 6 new confirmed cases. On Monday, it announced 4 more. In a news release this week, the Texas Department of State Health Services warned that in Alpine, all transmissions are assumed to be community spread. On Wednesday evening, Brewster County Judge Eleazar Cano announced the case total in Brewster had climbed to 22 total, saying most were due to community transmission. As the local crisis grew, Stephanie Elmore, the emergency management coordinator for Brewster County, made a state of Texas assistance request for around 300 more coronavirus tests, which would be for the hospital to use, she said. At least some of the tests are earmarked for her employees at an Alpine restaurant, which Elmore said had become a hotspot for coronavirus. Employees were there quarantining, Elmore said, and the restaurant was closing for 14 days to clean. When Brewster County got its first coronavirus case in April, DSHS contacted that patient, Elmore said. Otherwise, though, she's heard little about state contact tracing efforts in the region. I know they're supposed to, she added of state efforts, but she hadn't gotten the facts on aspects of the state's approach. In its own statement on Saturday, Alpine Independent School District announced that one of its staff members had coronavirus. They began a 14-day closure immediately, canceled all summer school for kids aged pre-K through 8th grade, and said buildings would be deeply sanitized. Texas is directing people to disinfection guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which recommended waiting 24 hours or as long as practical to clean, opening windows and doors and turning on fans to increase air circulation in the area, and disinfecting using EPA-registered disinfectants on all areas used by the ill persons, focusing especially on frequently touched surfaces. Alpine Public Schools also canceled their summer workouts and conditioning for athletes and the school summer meal program. Becky McCutcheon, the superintendent for Alpine ISD, did not respond to requests for comment by press time. Separately, Basecamp Terlingua, a short-term rentals company in Terlingua, said in a social media post that a group of 4 guests had all tested positive for coronavirus and that one had started feeling symptoms during their stay. Basecamp also said the guests did not heed our suggestion to stay out of local establishments. In response, Basecamp said it was conducting its own contact tracing, which included contacting a server at an area restaurant who may have been exposed. That's precisely the job that state health officials said they would do for the Tri-County. But as Texas plows ahead with its reopening strategy and contact tracing lags behind, that task is increasingly falling to Tri-County officials instead. Local residents and businesses are also joining in the effort for better or worse. In the case of Basecamp Terlingua, those positives will be counted in the guest's home county and managed by their regional DSHS department. At press time, Base Camp had not confirmed if they were contacted by any state tracing officials. When DSHS began tracing Marfa's first case, Nunez told health officials on June 5th that his family had stayed in place and left it at that. Local officials urged DSHS to look further into it, to which DSHS agreed. Even under quarantine, Nunez travels out of the region 3 times a week for dialysis, a regular emergency procedure required by some diabetics and people with other kidney issues to keep the organs in balance. Such trips are essential and considered a valid reason for travel, and Nunez speculated that might have been where he contracted the disease. But law enforcement authorities say that after being confirmed positive, Nunez was also making visits around town, violating quarantine rules. Last week, county officials warned that Nunez and his family had not been respecting control measures. For that reason, the Presidio County Sheriff's Office warned on social media, the probability exists of possible spread. In an interview with the Big Bend Sentinel, Nunez insisted that he and his family had been following quarantine rules, but Steve Marquez, chief of the Marfa Police Department, said he's received numerous calls from concerned citizens. One person said they saw one of Nunez's children at a local store. Two said they saw Nunez ordering from a restaurant. Another person in a store in Alpine put up a sign urging employees not to serve the family. Chief Marquez said he followed up on Marfa complaints with a warning for Nunez that he could face charges if he was violating quarantine orders. But the reports kept coming in. One person said they saw Nunez's wife at a park. One person said they saw Nunez's son at the post office. On Friday, two people called to report that Nunez was walking around town. Marquez called Nunez. He denied that he was in Marfa. According to Marquez, he advised me he was actually in El Paso for dialysis. Marquez said he just spoke to his wife and that they, the family, were all home. Nunez said he wasn't sure why people were reporting seeing him around town. It just kind of upsets you, he said of the situation. You don't really know what's going on, and then all of a sudden, everybody sees you everywhere. Some residents on social media were furious with Nunez over the alleged sightings. Others felt he was being unfairly turned into a pariah and rallied to his defense. An online meal train was set up for the family so the residents could donate and deliver food. 4 days after the case was confirmed, Judge Cinderella Guevara released a statement that a regional DSHS department had taken action to ensure the prevention of the introduction, transmission, and spread of the disease in this community. Namely, they issued an order that remains in effect until the person is notified by DSHS in writing, when the incubation period has passed and they are no longer suspected of having the communicable disease. Should the patient with COVID-19 not comply, they would be subject to criminal prosecution, the statement read. Nunez, who said on Friday that he was feeling fine, was cheered by the outpouring of support. It makes me feel a little welcomed, he said. Everybody is telling me to keep our heads up and get well soon. At press time, Guevara said Nunez and his family have not yet been released from their quarantine order by DSHS. Guevara wrote in her release that she was providing that information to the public in response to the many phone calls or texts with concerns of suspected person or persons not complying with control measures, adding, the only recourse for us in authority was to reach out to the Department of State Health Services Regional Medical Director. Nunez, the very first Marfa patient, said that state officials had been regularly calling him. They've been contacting us every day, he said, just to tell us to stay at home and stay in place until our quarantine days are over. For the county judge, contact with DSHS is less regular. The only details they'll give me are what to do when someone is positive. And then they'll give me the generalized information that we have received, Guevara said, including information like the anonymous person's gender, a rough suggestion of their age. She added that because she is not a doctor, the state would give more information to the local health authority. But Dr. Schwartz, the local health authority, isn't hearing much either. The last time I talked to them, I had to pursue them, talk to them, and pin them down, and I think that's indicative of how poorly they're handling this, said the doctor. Schwartz said he would like to state the state to provide better instructions and guidelines for those who test positive and to supply a caseworker that checks on them and helps them access services or get meals while they are mandated to stay home. He also called for more comprehensive testing than the sporadic one-day events in the Big Bend region and for more communication between the state and county. Coronavirus, live updates for the Big Bend region by Abby Perot, Stephen Paulson. Last updated June 10th, 4:39 p.m., read by Melanie. Presidio County has confirmed a positive case of COVID-19 in Marfa today. The case is a male in his 40s who has recently traveled to multiple nearby cities that have coronavirus outbreaks. The man is quarantining with four other family members, and the state is treating the situation as one positive and four probables. The Regional Office of the Department of State Health Services has already begun contact tracing to determine whether the family has had contact with anyone who would need to be alerted. It is the second confirmed case in Presidio County, with the first being a woman in Presidio confirmed on May 23rd. Hundreds turn out for Black Lives Matter March. June 10th, 2020 by Abby Perot, read by Melanie. Alpine. Hundreds of Big Bend residents gathered for a Black Lives Matter demonstration on a hot June morning last Saturday in Alpine. With an estimate of over 300 attendees, it was one of the largest protests in the Big Bend's recent history. The peaceful gathering echoed a movement across all 50 states, where over 700 protests have demanded justice for the deaths of Black Americans at the hands of law enforcement. Cedia Woods, an African-American Sul Ross State University student, led the march down Holland Avenue with a bullhorn with chants of "Color is not a crime" and "There are no excuses for human rights abuses." Residents and business owners stood in doorways as the march processed. David Busey, a local jeweler, was in his shop when the protest came by. "It's a national situation, and Alpine is just a reflection," he said, calling the event a good thing that was very appropriate for these times. Others, like Alpine resident Wyatt Kibbe, said he was there on Holland Avenue to make sure things didn't get out of hand, like it had in larger cities. Sporting a Make America Great Again hat, Kibbe said, "People can do what they want to do, but it's so far away from where it originally happened." The Alpine protest on Saturday materialized almost 2 weeks after George Floyd, a Black man from Texas, died from asphyxiation from sustained pressure when a Minneapolis police officer used an unauthorized restraint of a knee on Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes. A bystander filmed the incident, which went viral and sparked protests that have already led to police reform from New York to Minnesota. For Lauren Martinez, a mother in Alpine, it was Floyd's cries for his mother as he suffocated that hit her hardest. Martinez said she attended the march because, "If I don't support it, would my child be next? I have four biracial children, and they are just amazing, and I can already see a trend where they are targeted." Saying she has noticed the color of their skin gets them less favor. When the march arrived at the Brewster County Courthouse, Wood stood on the steps, overwhelmed and in tears, as protesters flooded the lawn. Addressing the crowd, she said, "For generations, African Americans have been fighting this fight. It is unfair that I am 22, have a whole life to live, and I'm ready to die for it. That's a problem." Calls for change from Woods were hemmed with a message of love, and the student continually emphasized the need for a conversation, at one point addressing the counter-protester who was yelling over her, saying, "I love you," and asking to speak with him afterward. A message of racial justice in Alpine was ringing out from Woods, a student who attends Sul Ross, a university named for a Confederate general, in a county named after a Confederate colonel. Day Leva took to the steps to speak about living in Alpine as an Afro-Latina woman, having to moderate her behavior more than her white peers in order to avoid negative attention from police or authorities. "Educate your children so my kids don't have to do what I'm doing right now," the young college student implored. Alpine Mayor Andy Ramos and Brewster County Judge Elizar Cano both spoke in support of the event. Ramos said his ancestors were slaves and buffalo soldiers, and that the racism he experienced growing up in Fort Davis had been overcome with the work of the League of United Latin American Citizens and other organizations. But there's still racism all over here. It's been hidden and compressed. And now with our president, it's reared its ugly head, Ramos said. My generation, we did a lot of good, but we stagnated. We need a push in the butt, and you guys are the ones to have to do it, Ramos told the young people in the crowd. You have to bring social change to this world. What you're doing, the movement, has spread across the world. Alpine's march caught national attention. It was written about on the New York Times website, featured on The Rachel Maddow Show on MSNBC, and discussed on the Texas Standard, a radio show syndicated across Texas. Days later, West Texas saw another Black Lives Matter event take shape in Presidio, where a small gathering of young people marched in solidarity with Black Americans. At the Alpine demonstration, Woods pushed for the small community to start opening up conversations about race as the next step. The event successfully registered 20 new voters and connected protesters to funds and phone numbers to call to demand change. For Martinez, she hopes to see certain changes after the nationwide protests too. I would like for everybody on both sides to maybe get more training, stop racial profiling in police departments, and I feel like maybe everybody as a whole could use a workshop, she said, to discuss racism and teach new skills to civilians and police alike. Martinez attended with Jessica Torres, another mother concerned for her biracial children. Martinez said, "We went to support the entire cause, but mainly to try to change something for them, so maybe they can have a normal life and not end up a hashtag." Presidio youth take to streets to support Black Lives Matter movement. June 10, 2020, by Beck Andrew Salgado, read by Melanie. Presidio. Passionate chants permeated the Presidio streets Tuesday evening as emphatic protesters marched up and down O'Reilly Street while clinging to cardboard signs that read, "Fight the power, Black Lives Matter, and matter is the minimum." The group of 14 young protesters, who were escorted by five Presidio police trucks that were present for the protesters' safety, congregated at the Presidio High School track before proceeding to march down to the Santa Teresa Church. Along the way, chants of "No justice, no peace," and "Black Lives Matter" were repeated as protesters walked with their fists up in the air. After seeing the wave of protests that have materialized in each and every state across the country, Presidio High Class of 2019 graduate Leilani Chavez decided something needed to be done in Presidio. Chavez, who lives in Las Vegas now, expressed that seeing everything that was going on and not being able to be home while it started really took a toll on her, and so she decided to come home and organize a protest of her own in Presidio. To urge people to join her in the streets of Presidio, Chavez took to Facebook and Twitter with an impassioned post that spotlighted the injustices behind the death of George Floyd. The post continued saying, "I want to be able to show the world that small towns like mine are standing with them, showing our support." The post was retweeted and shared across social media to bring awareness. Chavez, who was pleasantly surprised by the turnout, said that while the Black Lives Matter protests are more prominent in bigger cities, she felt they still needed to be represented in smaller ones too, because we all want to be one. Representing the Black Lives Matter movement was important to the Presidio resident, Jalen Goldston, who said, "Seeing all these people and reading all these stories about what's happening across the country is hurtful. For her, knowing that it could happen to me anytime is more than enough to encourage her to take to the streets to advocate for change." Goldston stated, "I'm like one of two, maybe three Black people in this town. And so she felt it was crucial for her to represent the movement where she lives in hopes of outliving the injustice that has plagued people just like her." Furthermore, Goldston stated that the protest was needed because Presidio is not a place where people are active on social media. And so she felt it was important to make a public statement in an attempt to help people become more aware of what is happening in the world. As the protest progressed, Presidio Mayor John Ferguson joined in, and the crowd embraced his presence with cheers. Ferguson, who was impressed with the efforts of the young protesters, urged them to stay with the Black Lives Matter movement, which he feels is of the utmost importance. At the civic level, the state level, and the national level, Black lives really do matter, said Ferguson, as he expressed that just talking about it is not enough. Rather, we need to prove it with our actions on a daily basis. For Presidio in particular, Ferguson feels that, in conjunction with the national conversation surrounding police brutality, some people may assume that those same injustices do not happen in small towns. But he highlighted the importance of being aware and involved to ensure that those injustices, in fact, will not happen in Presidio. And so, in that same vein, he applauded the protests. Ferguson also spoke to the group of protesters, saying, "As long as I am mayor of this city, the police will treat people with justice and be fair." Additionally, he referred to the protesters as the future of Presidio, the future of the world. After just over an hour of marching, the crowd reconvened at the Presidio High School field, where water was handed out and final words of encouragement were shared. While gathered in a circle, young protesters emphasized the importance of having empathy with other races and ethnicities during a time of strife. One protester raised their voice with the final statement, "Today for them, tomorrow for us."
Hello, this is Sonia reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, June 11th, 2020. FSISD Board Deadlocks on Police Proposal by Steve Fountain. The Fort Stockton ISD School Board deadlocked on a resolution that would have started the process for the district to create its own police force. With Board President Billy Espino not in attendance, the vote was 3-3. Anastasio Dominguez, Tom Ezell, and Andy Rivera voted in favor of the resolution, countered by no votes from Sandra Marquez, Flo Garcia III, and Freddie Martinez. Dominguez indicated that he would like to return the resolution to the board on its June 22nd regular meeting, when, presumably, all seven board members would be present. The resolution is a required first step in the process, but would not lock the district into creating its own police force, Superintendent Ralph Trainum told the board, adding that 10 steps are required by the state to complete the process. He said the goal would be to eventually have one officer on each of the five campuses, but that hiring one is all that is needed to start. With school set to start in August, Rivera asked if the process could be completed in time for the school year. "I don't think it's undoable," Trainum said. Marquez voiced concern over student safety and alluded to the inability of the district to reach an agreement with the city on the police department, providing school resource officers, SROs, on campus. "We really need to put all that on the back burner and think about the kids," she said. Trainum and Wolf said that there is no animosity toward the city and that the district would continue to work with local enforcement even with its own police force. "There are certain things a cop has to worry about," Dominguez said. "Our cops have been doing a great job, but if we have our own police department, their first concern will be the protection of our school, and they will stay with us." About 100 school districts in the state operate their own police forces. The resolution included a reference to local law enforcement being limited and that response time to the school campuses is 7 minutes. Contacted June 10 by the Pioneer, Fort Stockton Police Chief Robert Lujan said that he was not aware of a 7-minute response time. Lujan said the district's resolution comes as the city is entering its budget process for a fiscal year that starts October 1st. "We are open to dialogue with them," Lujan said. "They haven't reached out to us. We're in the middle of the planning of the budget for next year." The FSPD currently has 2 employees who were hired as SROs, with their payroll covered by reimbursement from the FSISD. He said the department will absorb 2 positions if they are not needed for FSISD assignments, but would need to act quickly if the department needs to provide SROs for the coming year. Lujan also mentioned that his department will add a new officer on July 15, a process that has taken 3 months from job posting to hiring. He voiced concern about the FSISD being able to recruit, screen, and hire an officer by August. School calendar. The district has already approved a calendar for the 2020-2021 school year that mirrors schedules previously used with schools starting in mid-August and ending in May. However, the state has been recommending that districts lengthen the school year in the event of another shutdown due to a resurgence of COVID-19. At the meeting, the board discussed adopting a calendar that would start classes on Monday, August 3rd, and end the year on Wednesday, June 9. It would include a three-week winter break from Monday, December 21st, to Friday, January 8. Four parents spoke in opposition to the calendar, citing childcare issues, visitation issues with families who share custody of children, and the potential toll the longer year would take on students. Two parents told the board they were fine with the change. The board members and superintendent encouraged the public, teachers, and school staff to share their views on the schedule. In other action, the board allowed Robert Knight to withdraw his resignation. Knight is a counselor at the middle school. Knight was in good standing with the district at the time of his resignation. The board was told Knight's plans that had prompted the resignation had changed. Held a budget workshop to review financial numbers ahead of the start of the budget process. With nearly $5 million in debt paid down prior to the failed bond measure last year, the district is anticipating a lower tax rate and slightly lower revenues for the upcoming school year. Revenue is forecast at $30,105,378, down $1,257,635 from last year. Expenditures are forecast at $32,511,151, down $551,878 from last year. The current projections, which also include a decrease in average daily attendance, ADA, funding with 110 fewer students, leaves a deficit of $2,405,773 to be resolved. Looking at the primary cost centers for the budget, teacher salaries account for $20,056,695 of the forecast. The teacher housing construction, which is being paid out of the general fund after failing to be approved as a bond, is $5.8 million, followed by tennis court lighting project at $388,765, and the lease agreement for computers for teachers is $334,091. Breakfast, lunch. The district is continuing to provide free breakfast and lunch to children through at least June 30th. Meals are distributed at the intermediate school between 7:30 and 9:30 a.m. and 11:45 a.m. to 12:45 p.m., Monday through Friday. The drive-through service is set up with entry from 3rd Street. Census Work Resumes Locally by Steve Fountain. The U.S. Census resumed its field work in Pecos County late last week, with enumerators working neighborhoods to verify addresses and housing locations and to distribute official census forms. Field work by census workers has been on hold amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Many residents in Fort Stockton received invitations by mail at their home earlier in the year to complete the census online, by phone, or by mail. This is the first census with an online response option. However, census forms are not mailed to P.O. boxes, which means a slower start to rural areas without home mail delivery. To date, Pecos County had a 36.3% response rate, according to Oscar Arriaga, media specialist with the U.S. Census Bureau. He said that 23% of respondents did so online. Neighboring Terrell County has a 10.6% response rate, with 10.3% responding online. For the city of Fort Stockton, the response rate is 47.6%, with 31.8% responding online. Ira Ann is at 8.1%, with 7.9% responding online. However, census officials say more of the census forms in the area will be delivered by hand in the coming days. Numbers are not available for unincorporated areas like Imperial, Cayenosa, and Sanderson, according to Arriaga. Statewide, Texas has a 55.3% self-response rate as of June 4th. In the 2010 census, the self-response rate was 65.4% in Fort Stockton and 54.9% in Ira Ann. Our goal is to have a 100% complete and accurate count of all cities and counties, Arriaga said. Pecos and Terrell counties are coordinated by the El Paso Area Census Office, which covers the counties of El Paso, Hudspeth, Culberson, Loving, Reeves, Ward, Winkler, Ector, Crane, Midland, Upton, Pecos, Jeff Davis, Presidio, Brewster, and Terrell. We have resumed delivery of census questionnaires in rural areas where the majority of households do not receive mail at their home, Arriaga said. Census field staff canvass the area for places people might live, compare what they see to our address list, Use a laptop to verify, correct, delete, or add addresses, and leave a census invitation and questionnaire at the front door. The form delivered by hand to a home of living quarters include a paper questionnaire along with instructions for responding online or by phone. The households will have the option of responding by mail, by phone, or online. Need a form? Census takers are currently dropping off forms locally. However, if you do not receive a form, you may call 844-330-2020 to complete the questionnaire by phone. Visit 2020census.gov, click Respond Now, then click on the link below the login button that says, If you do not have a census ID, click here. As a safety note, census workers have an official identification card with their name and photo on it. A census worker will never enter a house. County on track for 75% capacity. Down to 3 active cases of COVID-19 by Steve Fountain. Pecos County is among 115 Texas counties on track to move businesses to 75% capacity starting Friday, June 12, according to the state's Health and Human Services Office. The county has 3 active COVID-19 cases as of June 10. In total, the county has had 31 confirmed cases and 28 recoveries. Just last week, the county found itself listed with as many as 102 cases by the state, but the spike in numbers was due to confirmed cases among the inmate population at the Texas Department of Criminal Justice's N5 unit. The Texas Attorney General's office announced in June 4th that inmates at prisons who test positive for COVID-19 will not be counted toward a county's active case total, according to Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster. Thus, the county is well below the state threshold of 3 active cases per 1,000 population, or about 45 cases, and is now able to continue to the 75% capacity level. Without the AG's decision, Pecos County would have at least 67 active cases and exceeded the threshold. Instead, Pecos County is down to 3 active cases. The county has yet to see a hospitalization related to COVID-19. Schuster maintained that since the inmates were not circulating in the public, they should not be counted and adversely affect local businesses. Staff of TDCJ will still be counted on the county's numbers should active cases develop because of their access to the community. Part of the confusion in numbers resulted from the TDCJ reporting its numbers directly to its office in Austin, while the county reports its numbers to the Texas Department of State Health Services, Region 910 office in El Paso. That office assigns each case a number in addition to deciding to which county a case will be assigned. None of the cases the TDCJ reported to Austin were assigned case numbers, as is the case with those reported to DSHS. The 3 active cases are case number 29, 20-year-old male who is a Pecos County resident but was tested on May 26 out of state, possible contraction from out-of-state family, quarantining out-of-state. Case number 30, 39-year-old female tested May 31st at Midland Memorial Hospital, source of contraction unknown, self-quarantining at home. Case number 31, 41-year-old female employee of Focus Care Facility in Crane, not Fort Stockton, tested June 2nd at Pecos County Memorial Hospital, self-quarantining at home with family. Body found in abandoned vehicle. An investigation by the Fort Stockton Police Department continues in the case of a man found dead in an abandoned vehicle on June 8. The body was discovered by 2 young people in a vacant lot off North Sycamore Street between Dickinson Boulevard and U.S. Highway 285 behind the Atrium Hotel. Police responded to the call at about 8:50 p.m., according to Fort Stockton Police Chief Robert Lujan. Lujan said the man's body was transported to Lubbock for an autopsy and that the investigation was continuing. The case was initially called an unattended death. Lujan said the car where the body was found was among several abandoned vehicles in a row behind the Atrium Hotel, and that the vehicles are sometimes occupied by transients. In addition to the vehicles, the lot also had a dump pile containing mattresses, appliances, trees and branches, and other items. When asked by the Pioneer via text June 9 if the lot was in violation of any city codes for commercial property, City Manager Frank Rodriguez replied, "We are looking into it and will take all appropriate action necessary."
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News on Thursday, June 11th. New coronavirus case documented in Ward County. A new case of COVID-19 was discovered yesterday when test results of a Monahans man was returned as positive. The test was done at the Sand Hills Family Clinic on Tuesday. The case is travel-related and not community spread, as the man was exposed in Odessa. He is cooperating with the Department of State Health Services and is self-quarantined. This is the second Ward County case. The patient of the first documented case has recovered. The county has now reported 278 tested, 2 confirmed, and 1 recovered. As of Tuesday, 75,616 cases have been reported in the state in 235 counties, with 1,836 deaths. A total of 50,439 have recovered, 67%. United States totals are 1,938,823 cases, with 110,375 deaths. Purchase of new lab equipment okayed to speed up COVID testing. Tranquility Room dedicated to Sarah Davey. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. During the regular meeting of the Ward Memorial Hospital Board of Managers last Thursday night, the purchase of new lab equipment to speed up COVID-19 testing and a contract for a new EMS transfer service were acted on and approved. Hospital CEO Leticia Rodriguez told the managers that new equipment that will return results for COVID-19 tests in as little as 45 minutes is available. The normal cost of the units from BioFire Diagnostics of Salt Lake City, Utah, is $35,000 each, but can now be purchased for $21,000 each in sets of 2. Quote, buying 4 units will give us plenty of capacity for our lab. In addition to COVID indicators, respiratory panel, GI test, and blood panels can also be done. Since we will use this for coronavirus testing, the COVID money we received can be used to purchase the equipment. As such, the costs won't come from our regular budget, Rodriguez said. The $84,000 cost to purchase the 4 units was approved, and delivery is expected in late August to early September. The hospital COVID-19 update was also provided by Rodriguez. A special room has been established in the hospital called the Tranquility Room. The room will provide hospital staff members a place to relax and get away from the stress of dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. The room is quiet, with soft lighting and even a massage chair to help staff decompress. The room was formally dedicated on Wednesday morning to Sarah Davey, an RN who worked at the hospital, who was tragically killed in an automobile accident in August of 2018. Her husband, Lauren, and family members were present for the dedication. A plaque commemorating the event has been placed on the door of the room. Quote, it is a fitting tribute to Sarah, as she was loved by all who knew her, Rodriguez said. An agreement to provide ambulance transfer services to other facilities was approved by the managers. The agreement with Occupational Health and Safety International, OHSI, will provide ambulance transfer services on a sliding scale cost based on number of loaded patient and vehicle miles per month. For 0 to 1,200 miles per month, the cost will be $7,500 per month. 1,201 to 2,400 miles, the cost will be $5,000 per month. 2,401 to 3,600 miles, the cost will be $2,500 per month and no charge for mileage over 3,600. OHSI will charge payers, including insurers, Medicare, and Medicaid, the pre-negotiated rates where applicable. OHSI also has the same agreement with Winkler County Memorial Hospital in Kermit. Also, Rodriguez said that patient visits to the Sandhills Clinic is starting to increase again after dropping off because of coronavirus worries. Quote, on Tuesday, we had 98 patients. We had dropped to about 40 per day, so this is good news, she said. Payment of bills totaling $752,000, as presented by CFO Craig Morris, was approved. Avery charged in rape of 17-year-old. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Monahans Police Department officers arrested a Mississippi man suspected of sexually assaulting a 17-year-old female after he displayed a weapon. Cyril Malik Avery, age 24, of 707 South Kenneth, has been taken into custody on aggravated sexual assault charges. According to Monahans Police Department Captain Christopher Quintana, quote, the victim made a statement at the police department saying on June 2nd she had been at a residence in the 700 block of South Kenneth visiting when Avery brandished a weapon and raped her, end quote. Through the investigation, officers were able to identify Avery and an arrest warrant was obtained. Quote, an evidentiary search warrant was executed on the residence and the weapon that was used in the commission of the offense was located at the home, but Avery was not there, he said. With the assistance of the United States Marshals and the Texas Rangers, officers were able to locate Avery in Grand Falls on June 5th. He was subsequently arrested and taken to Ward County Jail. Avery was charged with aggravated sexual assault, a second-degree felony. He is also being held as a fugitive from justice on a felony warrant out of Mississippi. Bond for the aggravated sexual assault charge are set at $40,000, and he has no bond on the fugitive from justice hold. Avery has signed extradition papers and will be returned to Mississippi in the coming weeks.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.